This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Few people in America know more about the mafia than my guest, investigative reporter Selwyn Rabb, who spent 25 years covering the mob for the New York Times. He wrote a detailed and colorful history of the Cosa Nostra called Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's now out in paperback. Rabb's book illuminates the mob's influence in dozens of areas, from its control of New York's Fulton Fish Market to its decision to market heroin in American cities to its racketeering in the construction and waste hauling industries, which drove up costs for millions of consumers and businesses. Besides his reporting for the New York Times, Selwyn Rabb worked as a television producer in the 1970s. As a reporter, he exposed critical new evidence in the Hurricane Carter case. He's the author of two other books, Justice in the Backroom and Mob Lawyer. I spoke to Selwyn Rabb when Five Families was first published. Well, Selwyn Rabb, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
You know, most of us have seen the Godfather films, and there's that memorable scene in Godfather 1 where the heads of all of the crime families sit around a big oak table with their cigars and make decisions as if they were, you know, the president's cabinet deciding how organized crime in America is going to be run. I think most of us look at that and think that's just a little exaggerated. How close did the mafia have to having a ruling body, a commission?
No question they did have a commission, which was started by their organizational genius, Lucky Luciano, in 1932, in which the point was that they needed some kind of regulatory oversight over territorial disputes and about other policy questions. Eventually, with the diminution of many of the families in other cities, it became essentially a New York-based commission, with other cities and families from other cities coming to them to run things through, including who was to be the boss of the other cities, except for one place, and that was Chicago. Chicago made its own decisions. But outside of Chicago, whether it was Philadelphia or Boston or Milwaukee or St. Louis or Detroit or Cleveland, they came to New York, to the five big bosses, to make sure that the five bosses in New York, by majority vote, approved of any decision like who was going to run the enterprises in those other cities. So it wasn't a wise decision. It wasn't a smart decision to defy New York.
Now, you wrote that Lucky Luciano's rules for organization kept the Cosa Nostra functioning well for 50 years. What were these rules?
Well, the rules essentially were an adaptation of what had been established in Sicily. The most important rule was omerta, which is both the code of silence and loyalty and manhood. That's the word they like to use, and honor. So the point was you never cooperated, and anything that took place in a family within a gang or a bogata was secret and could not be discussed with anybody else. So the major point was, one, silence, and two, absolute loyalty to the regime or to the boss, that you never questioned a decision. The other major thing that Luciano created, which was really an American adaptation and an American invention, was he created a chain of command on the idea that the family unit or the borgata would always exist regardless of what happened. If a boss died, was assassinated, was arrested, there was a structure. People could fill those jobs below the boss and the boss at the top. If the boss was eliminated, the way there were in other ethnic gangs, the Jewish gangs, the Irish gangs, which all existed, but had no table or structure of command, if you took out the top leadership of one of the other ethnic groups, they just disintegrated. They were loosely knit. But the mafia organization continued to exist. They were replacement parts. And that's why they have outlasted every other organized crime faction that has ever existed in the U.S.
As a measure of the penetration of the mafia in the early 20th century, you mentioned that they moved in on the kosher chicken industry. Why did they go there?
Well, it was an example of what happened in the 30s, essentially in New York. It was a very profitable industry, the kosher industry in New York City or the New York metropolitan area. And it was essentially the Lucchese family saw this as a terrific opportunity. They had been shakedowned by Jewish gangsters of the whole industry, the slaughterers, the people who raised chickens, and the sales of it. What they did was they saw it was a million-dollar industry. Prohibition was over. The mafia was looking for other ventures, and this looked perfect. They had the muscle. They moved in, kicked out the Jews, and ran it. As simple as that. Maybe they didn't eat kosher chicken, but they certainly profited from it.
There's also been this idea that the Cosa Nostra did not want its members to get involved in the drug trade, at least not directly. What does history tell us about the accuracy of that notion?
Well, it's a mixed industry. It's a mixed story. What happened was the mafia actually was pretty big in narcotics since its origin in the 20s and the 30s. But for the most part, as late as the late 30s, the Jewish gangsters or Jewish mobs that were still functioning were prominent or preeminent in narcotics. It was an important part of the mafia, but not an essential or not the most vital aspect of their business. Things changed after World War II. And what happened after World War II, there was some legislation passed in the 50s, which for the first time made narcotics a very heavy crime if you were for penalties. If you were convicted, you might get 20 or 30 years. And the bosses got together and said, this could be a problem. The problem is, for the most part, what the mafia was doing did not lead to lengthy prison sentences. So there was no compulsion, perhaps, for people to become rats, to talk, and to turn in higher people. The mafia was a little worried, especially Joe Bonanno, who ran one of the most powerful families in New York, the Bonanno family. Bonanno came up with an idea in the mid-50s that the best thing to do was to, in effect, create franchises, get the mafia out of the actual daily sale and the routine of doing business on the streets, or the retail business. So what he decided to do was he went to Italy, met with the Italian mafia in Sicily. There was a famous meeting in 1956 in Palermo where Bonanno made this offer. He said, we'll help the Sicilian mafia, which was beginning to thrive on narcotics and getting plants from the Middle East and from Turkey. And we'll help you bring in heroin. You bring it in. The American authorities have no real line on what you're doing. You're unrecognizable to them. You come in, we'll tell you where to set up shops and how to handle the street trafficking. You bring in the big supplies, you take care of the wholesaling, and what we'll do is we'll help you out, especially in the inner cities. And what organized crime, what the mafia got, was a kickback. They got a percentage. But they did not have to do any of the dangerous, dirty work.
You know, another part of mafia lore is that the mob controlled politicians and judges. How accurate is that? I mean, could they have a hand in deciding who the mayor was? Could they get help from the top, from the highest levels of City Hall?
No doubt that the mafia controlled many big city governments, New York, Philadelphia. They had a hand there, Boston, Chicago. No question. One of the ways they were able to do it is they had money, and they had volunteers, workers. They could get the vote out, and they could provide you with election campaign funds. The best example of that was New York, where Frank Costello, was really Mr. Tammany Hall, the major Democratic political organization in New York, for 20 years, and made no bones about it. Costello would have big fundraising affairs, sometimes for charitable groups, sometimes for the Democratic organization. Judges would appear. Legislators would come. Nobody was in the least embarrassed. Now, for the most part, this continued into the 70s. You still had many big cities where there were these affiliations, almost open affiliations. When things began getting hot in the 70s and in the 80s, it was done more discreetly.
One reason that I guess the mafia could operate with such, you know, wanton abandon in places like New York was that the FBI just was not, was leaving him alone. I mean, for decades, J. Edgar Hoover not only didn't investigate the mafia, he essentially denied its existence. Why do you think J. Edgar Hoover was so opposed to investigating the mafia?
Hoover was very savvy about the mafia, and he didn't want any part of it. The reasons are very simple. One, he did not have the ability with the kind of agents that the FBI recruited into the 70s, almost into the 80s. They were usually people from small towns who had no identification, no knowledge whatsoever about how the American mafia operated. And they were incapable of infiltrating them. Hoover was also very worried. He knew the only way you could undermine the mafia was actually by doing undercover infiltration. And that was dangerous. Dangerous in two degrees. One, that your own people might be corrupted. And two, that they might have to commit crimes. It wasn't worth it for him. Hoover wanted easy opportunities. He went after the bank robbers in the 30s. That got him plenty of headlines. In the 40s, during World War II, it was after spies, it was after German or Japanese agents. And then later he got obsessed with communism and leftist movements in America. And those were easy things to do. And secondly, the American Communist Party was not going to corrupt you, not going to pay you off. So he left the mafia alone.
Well, Selwyn Rabb, once Hoover was gone and the FBI did begin to investigate the mafia, they found it was very hard to make cases stick, very hard to get long penalties, which would put big guys in jail. And as you tell the story, perhaps the greatest hero of law enforcement is essentially a lawyer and eventually a law professor named Robert Blakey. What did he contribute to the fight against the mob?
Without Robert Blakey's intervention, we'd probably still have the most powerful mafia in the world operating in most of our big cities. Blakey almost single-handedly created the law that has led to the evisceration and the first crackdown on the mafia. It's called RICO, Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act. And that act was passed in 1970. Now, the important part of that was that until RICO, the higher-ups, the bosses, the capos, the consiglieres, the counselors, the underbosses, were virtually immune from prosecution. If somebody in the gang or the mafia got caught, they were usually low-level people. They never ratted. Nobody higher up was ever implicated. So they went out scot-free. The big shots continued. The organization was self-sufficient and just continued to prosper. Under RICO, if you were any way involved with that enterprise, you were equally guilty, whether or not you committed the crime. This, for the first time, gave the government, or at least the FBI, a shot at getting the big operators. What happened, however, was this law was passed in 1970, and neither the federal prosecutors nor the FBI wanted anything to do with it. They said it was a harebrained scheme invented by some law professor who had no idea about what was really going on. Blakey proselytized for a decade. He went around like an itinerant preacher, going to U.S. attorneys' offices throughout the country, lecturing FBI agents. Nobody wanted to take advantage of this new law. RICO was something new. No one dared to use it for 10 years.
So what changed? When did prosecutors take advantage of this tool?
The big breakthrough in RICO came in 1980. What happened was there was a new head of the FBI office in New York by the name of Neil Welsh, who was an iconoclast. Hoover had hated him, but Hoover was dead. Now Welsh was in a driver's seat in New York. And Neil Welsh was also a lawyer and read law journals. And he knew about RICO. And he sent two of his agents up to Cornell University, where in the summers in the 80s, Blakey was lecturing. He was lecturing about RICO. And they were impressed. They sat through these hearings, these lectures, and they said, this is a perfect weapon. Nobody's used it. They came back to New York and said, we've got this terrific weapon that nobody wants to use. At the same time, Rudy Giuliani became the U.S. attorney for what's called the Southern District, which is in Manhattan of New York. He knew about RICO. He was interested in RICO. He knew about Blakey. They had their own sit-downs. And they decided a perfect case would be a case against the commission in New York. The heads of the five families that ran New York and for the most part ran the country. Call it the commission case. Giuliani didn't personally prosecute it. It was prosecuted by Michael Chertoff, who's now in charge of Homeland Security. And that case became a milestone. They didn't convict the five bosses, but they convicted major people, including several bosses, in this celebrated commission case in 1986. And that was the breakthrough. It showed prosecutors throughout the country what you could do with RICO.
It was clear that an informer from the mob, somebody who talked to the government, risked execution. But there were plenty of situations where someone would cooperate with the government and prepare to rat on his mafia brethren, but the families were still around. Now, was there any rule about whether you could kill or threaten family members, wives, children, parents of a mob member cooperating with government?
Civilians were technically immune or technically safeguarded. You weren't supposed to touch anyone who wasn't involved in mafia matters. However, that's broken down. It started essentially in the 80s with this whole new generation of younger mobsters came in. They started going after family members, threatening anybody who had turned or had become a government witness, that maybe they couldn't reach you, but they would go after your family. And there have been many cases of that. And the most recent was only a year ago in the Bonanno family. Tapes were picked up by the FBI, overhearing mobsters saying, well, if someone's going to rat on me and I have to go away for 20 years or 30 years, why should that rat and his family, why should his kids survive when my kids will be in trouble? So all those rules are broken down. It's no longer a gentleman's game. That's one of the theories that they'll now use to try to prevent snitches, turncoats, rats that will get your personal relatives. There are no longer civilians. Everyone is now endangered if you rat.
And what happened in that case? Did the family members get harmed?
Well, the people who made the threats were arrested, and the family members were put into the witness protection program. So that's part of the witness protection program. Another element that Blakey dreamed up in the RICO law, another great positive step, the RICO law for the first time created a witness protection program, which meant that after you testified, after you served whatever sentence you served, you and your entire family would be given new identities, the government would take care of you, and that was a great encouragement to become a government witness.
The government's gotten some huge mafia players, you know, underbosses, bosses, capos, but, you know, the base level is a couple of hundred soldiers, which each of the family has, and they're the ones who are going out committing extortion, running bookmaking, running prostitution, running narcotics, and making money. If they take the bosses away, aren't the guys still out there on the street, you know, committing crimes and raising prices and, you know, corrupting unions?
The mafia in America is never going to be eliminated for two reasons. One is called gambling, and second is called loan sharking. They're symbiotic. They work together. It's the bread and butter. It's always been the bread and butter for the mafia. And that is continuing to go on. And as long as you have that, they have the seed money to do other things. They'll go into labor racketeering, Wall Street, all the new high-tech frauds, wide open to them. They don't have to have the knowledge of how to function or create these rackets. What they do is they pick up on it. Often, a fine example of how the mob moved into Wall Street was that many brokers on Wall Street got into financial problems. They couldn't go to banks for loans. They went to loan sharks. Once they got into loan sharks, the mob guys wanted not only their money to repay the loans, they wanted a piece of their action, whatever frauds they were committing in the brokerage industries. And that's the way they functioned for 70 years, and there's still plenty of wise guys who are ready, willing, and able to handle mafia business in America.
Selwyn Rabb's book is Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's now out in paperback.